Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. We take your phone calls during this hour. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, you can call me and we can talk about them together. If you see things a little differently than the host does and want to balance comment, that's excellent. Go ahead and call me up and we can talk about that too. So you'll need this phone number. It's 844-484-5737. Again, that number is 844-484-5737. We have some lines open for you right now, so let me encourage you to call at this time. I think yesterday we ended a show with like three calls waiting because they didn't call early. I mean it when I say call early. It makes a difference. You can actually get on the program if you call early. You might be able to if you call late, but there's a good chance you won't. So call as early as you can, 844-484-5737. Richard from Phoenix, Arizona is our first caller today. Hi, Richard. Good to hear from you.
Yeah. Hi, Steve. Hey, I think your position on the judgment, if I understand you correctly, is that the Great White Throne Judgment, the Judgment of the Nations, and the Olivet Discourse, and all the other times that Jesus mentions the judgment are all one and the same event. And dispensationalists seem to have a problem with this because in the Great White Throne Judgment, they see that the books are opened and the dead are judged according to their works. And they say, well, you know, Christians are not judged according to their works. And so they seem to have this, this block that they seem to want to exclude the Great White Throne Judgment from the general judgment that's going to take place. What do you say about that? What do we know for sure about that?
Well, I can't imagine why anyone would say that Christians won't be judged by their works. Every time there's a reference in the Bible to the judgment, it's always referring to a judgment that's based on works, including when Christians are in the judgment. For example, in 1 Peter chapter 1, it says in verse 17, if you call on the Father, okay, we're talking to Christians here, if you call on the Father who without partiality judges according to each one's work, conduct yourselves throughout the time of your sojourning here in fear. So Christians who call God their Father are to conduct their lives in the fear of God, knowing, it says, that God will judge impartially everyone according to their work. So that would be us too. God's not partial. Likewise, in Romans chapter 2, Paul says in verse 5 and following, but in accordance with your hardness and your impenitent heart, you're treasuring up for yourself wrath in the day of wrath and revelation of the righteous judgment of God, who will render to each one according to his deeds. Now he clarifies what it means, each one will be rendered according to his deeds. It says, eternal life to those who by patient continuance in doing good seek for glory, honor, and immortality. But to those who are self-seeking and do not obey the truth, but obey unrighteousness, indignation and wrath, tribulation and anguish, on every soul of man who does evil, of the Jew first and also of the Greek, but honor and glory and peace to everyone who works what is good, to the Jew first and also the Greek. So he talks about people who will be saved and people who will not be saved. And that's his way of explaining what he means when he says God will render to each one according to his deeds. There are many references to the judgment, and including the judgment of Christians. And every single one of them talks about works. For example, in Jesus' statement about the sheep and the goats, in Matthew 25:31 and following, he said, when the Son of Man will come in his glory with all his holy angels, he'll sit on the throne of his glory, and he'll call all the nations before him, and he'll separate between them the way a shepherd separates between the sheep and the goats. And then what does he do? He speaks to the sheep, and he said, or I think he speaks first to the goats, but he says, I was naked and you didn't clothe me. I was hungry, you didn't feed me. I was sick and you didn't visit me. And they'll say, when was that? And he said, well, when you didn't do it to the least of my brethren, you didn't do it to me. And then he says to the sheep, when I was naked, you clothed me. When I was hungry, you fed me. When I was sick and in prison, you visited me. And they'll say, when did we see you in those conditions and do that? He'll say, when you did it to the least of these my brethren. Then he says, these will go off into everlasting life, but the others into everlasting punishment. So it sounds like there's Christians and non-Christians there. And what is it based on? Works. In John 5:28, Jesus said, "Marvel not at this, the hour is coming in which all who are in the graves will hear his voice and come forth, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation." It's always about what you did. Now, of course, someone might say, "But I thought we're saved by faith, not by works." We are. We are saved by faith and not by works. But we're judged by our works, because the judgment is that which has to take into consideration the validity of our claim to have faith. Everybody's going to have faith on the day of judgment. Everybody's going to say, "Hey, I believe. Hey, I always believed." Well, God's going to say, "Well, let's take a look. Let's look at your works, and we'll see if you believed or not." Because James said, "Faith without works is dead." Paul said that what God is looking for is a faith that works through love in Galatians 5:6. So we see that everywhere in Scripture, we are saved by faith, we're judged by our works, because the works are the evidence. When you're at a judgment, when you're on trial, someone has to have some evidence of something. It's not enough just to say, "I plead innocent," or "I plead that I believed," or whatever. That's when evidence begins to be looked at. When, after you've heard the accused person's plea, that's when the evidence has got to be presented. So the evidence of our salvation is our works. And that's the only thing that the Bible ever says will be brought up as evidence for at the judgment. So there's no reason to object to the great white throne judgment being the judgment where Christians stand, just because it says in Revelation 20 that everyone was judged by their works. Well, that's what every passage in the Bible about judgment says.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in other words, if you have a living, true faith, it can't help but produce works. It has to produce works because you're connected
right
to the true vine.
That's correct.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Thank you for that clarification, Steve.
All right. God
really
bless you.
I appreciate it. Okay. God bless you, too. Talk to
Good
you
to talk to you. Bye now.
Okay.
And now, I don't know if we have another Richard from Phoenix, Arizona. We were just talking to Richard from Phoenix, Arizona, but on line two, it says Richard also. Is this another Richard from Phoenix, Arizona?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Are all of our listeners in Phoenix named Richard, I wonder?
No. Quite a few
right
of them.
Welcome to the program.
When Jesus was on the cross and had the two thieves there, the two criminals, and he said, "This day you will be with me in paradise." Is he talking about heaven, or is he talking about something different?
Well, that's a good question. There are some people think that Jesus went to heaven when he died, and some people think he went down to Hades when he died. The Bible doesn't really clarify that. His body certainly went to the grave, which is sometimes called Hades. Where he consciously went, we really aren't told. Most people believe that Hades had two compartments, one of which was called paradise and the other was not. The part that was not was the place where the wicked went and where there were flames and torment. The part of Hades that was called paradise, they take to be a place of comfort or, a reward or whatever. But it's not the same thing as heaven.
Okay.
Now, this view that Hades was split into two compartments seems to have, Christ's imprimatur on it by his teaching the story of Lazarus and the rich man. And so for those who think that the story of Lazarus and the rich man is a true story, they would say, well, Jesus has pointed out that we do have these two compartments. And therefore, they would say that when they died, Jesus and this man who repented went to that compartment in Hades called paradise. Now, others have had other opinions about that. Some people think that they went to heaven. But I don't think Jesus went to heaven prior to his resurrection. So I don't think that view would hold up.
Okay. All right. Appreciate it.
Okay, Richard. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Good, bye-bye. Good talking to you. Bye now. All right. We're going to now talk to Frank from Rockland, California. And if you'd like to be on the program, we have a line open at 844-484-5737. All right. Welcome to the Narrow, Frank. Thanks for calling.
Okay. I have, a contradiction or whatever.
Uh-huh.
In Acts 15, when the, I guess the apostles or the teachers or whatever, but they came up with a list of things that they didn't want the Gentiles to be doing. And one of them was sacrifice, eating food sacrificed to idols. And then in 1 Corinthians 8, Paul seems to contradict that in saying that there's nothing wrong with that. If you want to do it, you can do it. And if you don't want to do it, well, that's okay as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I see that's very perceptive, because at the Jerusalem Council, James requested that Paul and Barnabas, as they go to the Gentiles, should carry with them this letter from the council in Jerusalem requesting Gentiles to abstain from these things. Now, Paul, when he came to, you know, Corinth, which is one of the Gentile cities where he carried that letter, he taught them something when he was there, but when he left, he wrote back to them in 1 Corinthians about questions they had concerning meat sacrificed to idols. And he said, well, it's not anything that God really is offended by, but it might offend somebody else. He said, if it's going to stumble somebody else, then you shouldn't do it. So, in other words, the rightness or the wrongness of eating meat sacrificed to idols has nothing to do with God's preferences per se about that particular act, but rather whether it would be offensive to somebody else and stumble them. And so that's what Paul's concern is. Now, I believe that was James's concern, too. So I think that Paul is speaking in the spirit of James in this matter also, because he said in Acts chapter 15, where James writes this letter, he says in verse 20, but that we should write to them to abstain from things polluted by idols, that would be meat sacrificed by idols, to idols, from sexual immorality, from things strangled, and from blood. Then James said this, for Moses has had throughout many generations those who preach him in every city being read in the synagogues every Sabbath. Now, this is the reason that James gives for having these restrictions placed on the Gentiles, because there are many Jews in every city who've been taught in the synagogues the ways of Moses for many generations. And what that means is there's many Jewish people in every Gentile city who hold certain views on these things and who might very well be offended by Christians who neglect these rules. I mean, eating blood was one of the things that Jews really found disgusting. Eating meat sacrificed to idols, likewise, was considered to be compromised with idolatry by the Jews. Now, things strangled and things that... Yeah, there's actually nothing in the Old Testament about things that are strangled, actually, or, of course, sexual immorality is in there. We can see that these are things that Gentiles typically practiced throughout the world. That is, Gentiles who are not Christians. They ate blood, they ate meat sacrificed to idols, they fornicated, they apparently ate meat that was strangled. These things were offensive to Jewish people. And James said, listen, in every town where you're going to find Christian Gentiles, you're going to find Jews too. Moses had those people in every town for many generations who were taught weekly in the synagogues these things. So why don't we ask the Gentiles not to do those things? Because, well, I think that by implication, because they're offensive. It'll give the Jews the impression that Gentiles who follow Jesus are engaged in really disgusting behaviors, and it'll turn them off to Christianity. And so that was Paul's concern also. When Paul came, he delivered that letter as he was told to do. And he did tell them that he'd like them to abstain from idols, to avoid from meat sacrificed idols, to avoid stumbling people. But he apparently gave them this caveat when he was with them, saying, you know, this matter of what you eat, it's not really an absolute moral issue with God. This is more for the sake of not offending people. And when Paul left, some in the Corinthian church misunderstood him and thought he was just saying, well, it doesn't matter then what we eat at all. And they were doing it in a way that's offensive to other people, eating in front of people who had convictions about it, like the Jews. And so Paul had to write to them and says, now don't do that if it's going to offend people. He said, all things may be lawful to me, but not everything's going to edify. Not everything's profitable. And so he had to sort of walk back his teachings a little bit, because he had apparently told them that while it's important not to offend people by what you eat, that in God's sight, there's nothing particularly wrong with these actions. And so these people started to not care what other, you know, who they affected. They just decided to take their liberty, and Paul had to write to them and tell them, wait, that, no, that's not, it's not good. It's not loving to offend your brother. So we do find Paul talking differently here than James did. But I believe that Paul and James had exactly the same concern, and that when James said, let's ask them not to do these things, he actually says, because, and if we interpret James's words properly, I think he's saying, because there's lots of people who will be offended by this behavior. And that's Paul's exact concern, too. He's saying these things may not be wrong in themselves, but if it's offending people and stumbling people, that's not good. So don't do it then.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, I appreciate your call. God bless you. All right, our next caller is Mike from San Francisco. Mike, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, you're welcome, Greg. Steve Gregg.
That's all right. People do that all the time.
Okay. I enjoy your show. I really admire your views. I was wondering about the two witnesses in the book of Revelation, if they could be Enoch and Elijah, and also your view on Revelation 12 about the woman and her child and her offspring. And also, three quick questions. What's your opinion on the book, A Course in Miracles? I'll take my answer off the air, and thank you. God bless you.
All right. Well, thank you for your call. God bless you. Let me take the book of miracles, the Course in Miracles. I think you mean the Course in Miracles, don't you? There is a book called A Course in Miracles, which professes to be dictated to the author by Jesus, so that it's like Jesus is the one talking in the book, and he's, you know, teaching about how to do miracles. First of all, I don't believe it's Jesus. I don't believe that it's I don't think it's genuinely inspired by Jesus. Secondly, I don't think that Jesus would give a course in miracles, because that would suggest that there's techniques that have to be learned. There's principles and techniques to working miracles. I don't believe there are. I think that's more occultic thinking. In the occult, if you want supernatural things to happen, you have to learn the techniques. You have to learn the spells. You have to learn the way to manipulate things to make it happen. In the Bible, real miracles from God are not manipulated. They're not even inaugurated by people. It's true, sometimes people are God's spokesperson for it. So Peter might look at a lame person and says, Aeneas, Jesus Christ heals you, get up. Or there would be other times when Peter or Paul or some other person would be speaking for God and working a miracle. But they do so only at God's, inspiration. God tells them when to do it. We know this is true because Paul couldn't heal everybody. And if anyone knew, you know, if there were any techniques of miracles, Paul knew them. But there aren't any. Paul just had to know when God wanted to work a miracle and when he didn't. Paul had a friend named Trophimus that he left sick in Miletum. He says that in 2 Timothy chapter 4. Why didn't Paul heal him? Paul certainly knew all the techniques. If there was a course in miracles, he had taken it and he knew it, because he had done that kind of miracles many times before. But I believe we have to understand that sometimes God wants to work a miracle and sometimes he doesn't. If God does, you don't need to take a course in how to do it. God will give you the faith and give you the words and so forth to work it. If God doesn't want to work a miracle, then no amount of techniques is going to make him do so. Now, techniques might in fact bring about supernatural results, but there's no guarantee those results be from God. Because, like I said, there's all kinds of occult practices that bring about spiritual, supernatural results, but they're not from God. And one difference between a real miracle and an occult supernatural wonder is that a real miracle is instigated by God himself. An occult practice is instigated by the practitioner, the person who's working the deal, working the spell or whatever they're doing. And so I don't believe that a course in miracles is even in keeping with what the Bible teaches about miracles, and I don't believe that the Course in Miracles book has its origins in Jesus at all. Okay, that's my thought. As far as the two witnesses and the woman, the pregnant woman in chapters 11 and 12 of Revelation, I really wish that people, if they really want to understand what I think about these things, would do one of two things. You can do something for free. You can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, where my lectures on every book of the Bible, verse by verse, are there, including Revelation. And it's a very simple thing. Go on your computer, click on Revelation 11, click on Revelation 12, and you'll get a very comprehensive treatment of those chapters, and you'll know exactly what I think. And I say that not because I don't want to say it here, but because I can't say it in detail here. Whenever someone asks me something about Revelation, I kind of am in dread, because I think, okay, these people probably have certain assumptions about Revelation that I don't share. And for me, in order for me to tell what I believe, I almost have to go back and tell all the different presuppositions I'm making. For example, I don't think Revelation is about the future, primarily. I think, and most people do. I don't think the two witnesses are two individuals. Most people do. And so forth. And these differences, in order to even, answer the question, I have to set it up by telling how I feel differently on all these different points, and then I can give my opinion. My lectures on Revelation at the website are 100% free. You just go, you can download them or just listen to them on your computer. The website is thenarrowpath.com. And when people ask about Revelation, I always wish they'd just listen to the lecture, because then they can get a full answer from me and not just some kind of an abbreviated, inadequate answer here. Another thing that is possible to do, this would cost money, but you can go out and buy my book, The Revelation Four Views, which also contains all that information and more. So, I mean, those are some resources. One of them is free. The other one would cost you money to get. But let me just say that I think the two witnesses in Revelation 11 represent the church. Not the church in the future, the church throughout the age of the church. And I believe that the woman who's pregnant with the child in chapter 12 is the remnant of Israel before Jesus was born. She's pregnant because Jesus is about to be born in the vision, and he is. The child is born, and it's Christ. Now, in the vision, he's caught up to God and to his throne, which, of course, happened after Jesus' resurrection. He was caught up into heaven. And then the passage that I think is largely following about the spiritual warfare of the church throughout the age of the church. Now, that might not make sense to anybody who doesn't have certain presuppositions that I have. And again, I don't have time to go into them all, but I would be glad for you to access them at thenarrowpath.com, the verse-by-verse lectures on Revelation. You asked if the two witnesses could be Enoch and Elijah. Well, if the two witnesses are two individuals, as many people think they are, Enoch and Elijah could be them, though there's no way to really say they would be. The only argument I've ever heard that would suggest that Enoch and Elijah may in fact be the two witnesses is that the two witnesses in the story do die, and Enoch and Elijah have not yet died. And often based on Hebrews 9:27, which says it's appointed unto men once to die, some people say, well, everyone's supposed to die, but Enoch and Elijah haven't died, so they have to come back and die, so those two witnesses will be them. I don't think that's an extremely strong reason to identify them that way. For one thing, I don't believe everyone does have to die. Paul said there's going to be a whole generation of Christians who are alive when Jesus comes back who won't die. So although the Bible does say it's appointed unto man once to die, there are exceptions. Elijah and Enoch could easily be exceptions. Some people think the two witnesses are Moses and Elijah. There's actually more reason to believe that than Enoch and Elijah, because the two witnesses do the same miracles that Moses and Elijah did. For example, they turn water into blood. Well, Moses did that. They smite the earth with all kinds of plagues. Well, Moses did that too. They can stop the rain for 3.5 years. Well, Elijah did that. And they can call fire out of heaven on their enemies. Well, Elijah did that too. So the miracles they do are reminiscent of Moses and Elijah. And if they are two individuals at all, Moses and Elijah would be a good theory. But as I said, I don't take them to be two individuals. I take them to be a representation of the church. But this doesn't make sense unless you have some idea of what my presuppositions are, which are why I teach and make my teachings available online. So you could get that, even though I don't have time to go into all of it on the air. I hope that may not be too frustrating, but the material is accessible instantly if you're by a computer. You can listen to it right after the show's over here. I appreciate your call, though. Thank you. Denise from Las Vegas, Nevada, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a quick, easy question for you about fasting and how you're supposed to do it in secret and not say anything. I struggle with that because I do announce to my family, okay, mommy's going to go on a fast tomorrow. So, you know, I just kind of brief them, you know, hey, don't come on up and ask me, do I want to share the bag of popcorn? I just do.
In fact, you might want to steer a wide berth around me, too.
Say it again?
You might tell them they want to steer a wide berth around you, too, when you're fasting.
So, tell me, what is your opinion? I mean, is it supposed to be this big grand secret where no one's supposed to know? I mean, I can't ask a sister in Christ, hey, pray for me, I'm going to embark on this 10-day fast. Pray for me, keep me in prayer, or you're not supposed to say nothing on Facebook after it's done. Wow, I did it, you guys. I did my 10-day fast. People get offended, seems like. What is the word? Tell me what's true.
Well, as you know, in Matthew 6, Jesus said, when you fast, don't appear to be fasting. Don't do what the Pharisees do. He said they put on a long face and they go out unkempt and ungroomed, and that
right.
everyone knows they're having a hard time and they're fasting and so forth. So that they'll appear to men to be fasting. Don't be like them. He says, when you fast, just groom yourself normally and don't let people know you're fasting. Okay. Now, of course, your question would be answered differently by people of differing degrees of legalism. If we're supposed to take the words of Jesus without context and without very much concern about what his real issues were that he was referring to, and we're just going to take it legalistically and verbally, then it would be wrong ever to tell anyone you're fasting, or probably that you had fasted. In fact, it would have been wrong for Jesus to have told his disciples that he fasted for 40 days, which he must have told them because they would otherwise have had no knowledge of it. There was nobody there but him and the devil, and I'm sure the devil didn't tell them. So, I mean, Jesus clearly reported to them his fast. And, you know, fasting was not entirely a secret thing. When Jesus said, don't be like the hypocrites, what he said is what they do is they want people to notice their fasting. They want to get the admiration and respect of people who will appreciate the sacrifice they're making by fasting. And therefore, their fast is not directed toward God at all. Their fast is directed toward their own reputation and their own ego. Now, that's what Jesus is speaking about. And he doesn't just speak about fasting by itself. He talks about giving alms. He talks about praying. He talks about fasting. When he talks about prayer, he also says, don't pray in public. He said, go into your closet and lock the door and don't let anyone hear you praying. And yet, Jesus prayed in front of his disciples. And the disciples prayed publicly, as we know in the book of Acts. So, what are we to make of that? I think we're supposed to not be legalistic and say, okay, what Jesus is trying to get across is that if I'm going to do anything to please God, I can't be doing it with a motive of getting a reputation for myself, of being a holy person. I can't be motivated by the desire for people to see me and appreciate me and admire me or whatever. That's what he's teaching. Now, there would be cases where you could be fasting, and others may discover it, but where you're not in the least interested in them knowing. You could be fasting and somebody can say, hey, you want some food? We're going out to eat. And you could just say no. And they say, well, have you eaten yet? And you say, well, I'm not eating. And they say, well, why not? I guess it's time to let you know. I'm fasting right now. The idea is not that people can never find out that you pray or give alms or fast. The idea is you can't be doing it with a mind to get their attention and to get their admiration and to have them think you're spiritual. And there's a huge temptation whenever you're doing anything that is in any sense a sacrifice to want everyone to appreciate the fact that you're doing it. You feel, you know, it's tempting to feel like you're a better person because you're doing it, and you'd hate to fail to have people recognize how good a person you are. And therefore, there's little sneaky ways to make sure that they find out, you know, and so forth. The issue is not whether people know you're fasting or not. If you tell your kids, you know, I'm not going to be eating tomorrow, I'm not going to be eating for the next 10 days or whatever, I'm going to be praying and I'm going to be, you know, passing on meals or whatever, it's not likely that you're telling them for the wrong reasons, and I wouldn't think there's anything wrong with that. Now, when you get on Facebook and say, I just finished a 10-day fast, there still might be no bad reasons behind it, but I'm not sure how many good reasons there would be for doing that. It seems to me like, you know, if you get on a Christian social media thing and say, I just fasted for 10 days, you know, if you can say that without any pride or any look at me or anything like that involved, then I can't see it as a sin to say it. But I'm just not sure, you know. People might say, well, why are you telling us this? If you say, well, because I just, I don't know, I'm just rejoicing about it. Well, I think that could be something that maybe you could rejoice privately about, just because if you do, you'll then know that you're not doing this in order to be admired, in order to be looked up to as a spiritual person. You're fasting, you're praying, you're giving of alms. It's not a bad thing if people find out about it. But it's, Jesus said, it's a bad thing if you particularly are eager for them to find out about it, because why would you want them to find about it? It's something you do to God, before God, and it's part of your, in a sense, part of your private relationship with God. So I mean it's just a matter of attitude. I'm not legalistic about such things. If I were fasting and someone offered me food, I wouldn't mind saying I'm fasting, so don't offer me more food, please, you know. But on the other hand, I wouldn't go on Facebook and announce that I'm fasting or that I fasted, just because I think, well, why am I telling them this? You know, what is it? What is it about it that they need to know about it?
Okay.
All right. Okay, Denise, I appreciate your call. Thanks for joining us today. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. Our next caller is Nancy from Napa Valley, California. We're going to be taking her call, but I want to let you know there's a line open for you. Actually, there's two lines open right now. If you'd like to be on the program, we're past the halfway point of the program, so you don't want to delay if you want to be on the program before we're done. The number to call is 844-484-5737. Again, that's 844-484-5737. All right. Nancy, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Thank you very much. I have a question about Paul. I was in a conversation with my brother over Thanksgiving, and I was mentioning Acts 17 when he goes to Athens.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was telling, we're in a conversation, and I said, well, do you know the rest of the story? And I said, well, I don't know. What's that? And he said, well, that when Paul had gone up against the Athenians and the great thinkers and was in these deep conversations and philosophy, that my brother said that he had tried to go up against them in his own knowledge and his own, you know, mental prowess or whatever, and that he left there very depressed. And in another book somewhere in the New Testament, which that's what I'm calling about.
1 Corinthians 1.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, 1 Corinthians 2, actually, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he said that from that point forward, that's when Paul determined to only preach Christ and him crucified.
Well,
is that accurate? Is that when he made the shift, or was there a shift?
That is a deduction that is probably reasonable to make. When Paul left Athens, he went to Corinth. And he ministered in Corinth for 18 months. And then later, after he left Corinth, he wrote 1 Corinthians, as he wrote back to the Corinthian church. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, when he wrote to them, he says, when I was among you, I didn't come with enticing words of men's wisdom. I didn't want your faith to rest in the wisdom of man, but in the power of God. He says, I determined to know nothing among you but Christ and him crucified. Now, Paul is talking about how he had come to the Corinthians and how, you know, what he had done. It's very clear he didn't bring philosophical arguments, and
okay,
that's what he's saying. Now, he had just come to Corinth from Athens, where he had that not very encouraging sermon that he gave on Mars Hill. In fact, he got laughed out of the podium.
Is that the one where he mentions the he tells them about the unknown God that they had
yes.
set up, and he begins? Okay.
Yes, when Paul is asked to speak at the at Mars Hill, at the Areopagus.
Okay.
He did talk about the altar they had, or the shrine they had to the unknown God, and he quoted some Greek philosophers, and some people feel that Paul was taking an intellectualized approach because he wanted to impress these intellectual Athenians.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in some measure, he might have been doing so. Athens was a philosophical city, but it's hard to imagine why it would be wrong when you're talking to philosophers to point out that even their own philosophers agree with some of the points you're trying to make, and that's what he said.
Mm-hmm,
we could jump to the conclusion that he had been in the flesh. We could jump to the conclusion that he had not been led by the Spirit and that he was just trying to make an intellectual impression. But I don't think reading the passage in Acts 17 necessarily gives that impression. It's one theory that people would have about it. In any case, he was somewhat probably deflated a bit in his
mm-hmm.
in his thinking about engaging the Greeks on their own terms, which was philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Not that Paul wasn't a good philosopher, but that their philosophies came from different worldviews. You see, they all were willing to listen to him when he talked about creation and when
mm-hmm.
he talked about, you know, the nature of God not being a stone and so forth. But when he said that Jesus rose from the dead, that's when they laughed at him. They didn't want to hear
mm-hmm.
anymore, because
mm-hmm.
Greek philosophy had certain presuppositions. Their worldview was that matter is evil, spirit is good, and that when you die, your spirit, your good spirit, is released from your evil physical body. And the idea of coming back into a physical body, back to evil again, was absolutely abhorrent to Greek philosophers.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the Jews believed in resurrection of the dead, but the Greeks didn't. So Paul, though his argument was frankly, I think it was philosophically airtight. I don't think
mm-hmm.
that Paul had, I don't think Paul had any defects in his reasoning skills or his philosophical sophistication. The problem was that he's trying to appeal to them in their philosophical notions by his philosophical understanding without their understanding the worldview and so forth that he tried to get across them. Now, was
right.
he not led by the Spirit when he did that? I don't know. I mean, he doesn't. He never says that he was not. We just know, all we know is that when he left there and went to Corinth, he didn't take the same approach. He
okay.
said, I determined to know nothing among you but Jesus Christ and him crucified. And
okay, so that's in 1 Corinthians.
1 Corinthians 2.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
2, okay.
So your brother may be correct. Your brother may be correct. There's a little bit of speculation in it, but it's kind of putting the pieces together of a puzzle, which might be, he might have the picture correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then one other quick thing about Paul, I forgot where I read it, but when he was converted on the road and all, he did not go out for over 12 years or something. Is that right? To preach?
Well, there was a season where he was away from Jerusalem, and we don't know what he was doing. He said he was
okay.
in Arabia. He tells us about this in Galatians chapter 1, and it's also recorded in Acts chapter 9, that when Paul was converted, he did preach right away because he came to Damascus. He was on his way to Damascus when Jesus met him and he was converted. Then when he got to Damascus, he started preaching the gospel right away. But he was opposed, and he had to escape from Damascus through a window in the wall in a basket. His friends had to lower him down so he could escape because the gates were being guarded to kill him. And then he went off from there to Damascus. He was in Damascus, into Arabia. Now, he says he went to Arabia, and then he says it was like 14 years later he came to Jerusalem. And so we have a 14-year gap between his departure from Damascus and his coming back to Jerusalem. We have no information about it, and many people think that Paul, during that time, was not preaching anywhere, that he was more or less in seclusion, receiving revelations from God, working out his theological understanding of things and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so they, many times people say that Paul spent 14 years without preaching. But we don't know that he didn't preach. He was preaching immediately in Damascus after he got saved. So he might have been preaching in Arabia, too, for all we know. We just have no record of what he was doing.
Right. Well, maybe it's like Moses in a way, where Moses thought he knew he was called to, and he killed the Egyptian, mm-hmm. and then he ran mm-hmm. and 40 years in the wilderness kind of a thing. Maybe Paul went and preached right away, which was fine, but maybe he realized in that he had a lot to learn or something.
That is a very common understanding, and it's simply based on the silence of Scripture about it.
Yeah,
we don't know what Paul was doing those 14 years. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I sure appreciate it. Thank you so much. Really appreciate your show.
All right, Nancy. Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
I appreciate your call. All right. We're going to talk next to Corey from Portland, Oregon. Corey, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to do a Bible study on the titles of Christ, mostly in relation to the title of Lord or Teacher. And I know Rabbi kind of sums up some of the translations for Teacher. I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and give me some insight.
About the word Rabbi?
Well, not Rabbi, just more like when the disciples traveled with him, did they call him Rabbi? I mean, would that be the word that they used instead of Lord?
Sometimes. I think we have record of him being called both, and both are legitimate titles for him. Rabbi, most translations render the word rabbi as teacher. Actually, the literal meaning of rabbi in Aramaic is my great one, and yet a disciple of a rabbi would call him my great one, rabbi, but the implication in the context is my great teacher. You're my teacher. I look up to you because you're a great one, and I'm your student. And so the meaning of the word rabbi, the etymology means my great one, but the usage of the term generally had the meaning of a teacher. Now, there was another Greek word, didaskalos, in Greek, which the New Testament also uses, which means teacher. But the disciples probably didn't speak to him in Greek, but in Aramaic, so probably they called him rabbi.
Okay, and so when did the change between rabbi or teacher go to Lord?
Well, I don't know if it ever changed. I think both these terms were used simultaneously, because the word Lord, kurios in the Greek, it was probably Adonai in their native language. It just means, well, it has a variety of meanings. It means sir, or it means master. And if you spoke respectfully to a man, you would call him kurios in Greek, or Adonai. You'd be calling him sir, or you'd be calling him master. If you were a slave, it would have special meaning. If you're a slave, your Adonai is your owner. But it didn't always have that meaning. It's also a word that in the Old Testament is often used of God. God was sometimes called Adonai. But again, it's not a name for God. It's more like my master. And so depending on context, the word Lord could just mean sir, or be a respectful way of addressing a man. It could, in some context, refer to God. When the disciples referred to Jesus as Lord, they probably didn't think of him in terms of being Yahweh or God, because that was not something they understood early on. That was something they, I think, came to understand much later. So I think when they spoke to him as Lord, and other people did too, even strangers would call him Lord, because that's just the way you address a man in that society. So he could be called Rabbi or Lord, either one, at the same time. It's not as if one is a development upon the other, or that one expresses an advance in appreciation for who he was over the other. He would have been called Lord throughout his entire life, just like all men would be if they were addressed respectfully. But he was also called teacher when people were addressing him as a teacher, or they could use the terms either way.
I see. Okay, well, thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, God bless you. Good talking to you. All right. Eric from Cowtown, California, Vacaville. Eric, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. My question is in regards to baptism. I've heard you mention in the past where baptism wasn't a requirement for salvation, but it was just to show your commitment. And I had some questions in regards to verses that I felt contradicted that.
Okay. Acts 26?
I'm sorry?
Acts 26, 1 Peter 3, Mark 16?
Well, probably one would be 1 Peter 3:21, yes.
Okay, yeah, 1 Peter 3. Mm-hmm. The like figure whereunto baptism now saves us. Uh-huh.
And Mark 16:16, he that
whosoever believes and is baptized will be saved, right?
Shall be saved. And then there's also Acts 2:38. They said, what should we do to be saved? And Peter said,
repent and be baptized for the remission of sins.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And then Jesus said, I think in John 3:5, verily, verily, I say unto thee, except the man born of the water and of the Spirit. I know people tend to say that the water was the first water that broke, but that wouldn't be a exclusion, or that wouldn't be a exception, because everybody's born over the water, obviously. So,
right.
I mean,
yeah.
Acts, the 1 Peter 3:21 is really the one where, as it said, as in the day of Noah, where 8 bodies were saved by water. I'm just remembering off the top of my head at this point, where 8 bodies were saved by water. Baptism doeth now save you, not putting away the filth of the flesh. Repentance.
Are you there?
Yes.
Oh, okay. It sounded like you kind of cut off in the middle of a sentence. Okay. Well, let me put it this way. First of all, I need to clarify what my view of baptism is, because it's not exactly as you represented it. I don't think that baptism is merely a sign, as if it's optional. I believe that we are commanded to be baptized. I think the function of baptism is as a sign, but I don't think it's an optional sign. I think it's mandatory. I think we're commanded to do it. Now, I believe that some people have been saved without being baptized, in the sense that they've been justified, like Abraham. Abraham wasn't baptized, but he was justified by faith. And repeatedly, the New Testament tells us that we're justified the same way he was, by faith. So when it comes to justification, justification is by faith. But salvation is more than justification. I would never say we are just saved by faith and baptism is not necessary. I would say we're justified by faith, but that's the beginning of salvation. So justification is the means by which we are reconciled to God. Now that we're reconciled by God, it's time for us to live the life of a saved person, and that means a life of obedience to Christ, which includes baptism.
I understand what you're saying in regards to Abraham, but Abraham was obviously passed before Jesus was ever crucified.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the like figure, and where Jesus was death and burial and resurrection for baptism. And
Let me ask you what you mean by saved. Because do you mean, when you say saved, are you talking about just, you know, going to heaven when you die?
No, I'm talking about faith in God in general. Because without faith, you wouldn't do anything. You wouldn't move. You wouldn't.
No. I'm not asking what you said. I'm not asking what you mean by faith. I'm asking what you mean by saved. What does saved mean in your question?
Oh, saved. Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. Mm-hmm.
To have salvation and being cleansed of your sin, I would say baptism is a requirement and actually a major portion of your salvation.
Okay, so let me ask you this. Abraham was cleansed of his sins by faith, correct?
I believe Abraham, yes, was he was a faithful father, and he walked a life according to the Torah at the time, and he lived a godly life.
Yeah, well, there wasn't a Torah yet at that time, but yeah, he just believed in God. Yeah, but he obeyed God. There was no Torah yet, he definitely did obey the Lord, and that's what people do when they believe God. If they are believers, they obey Him. Now, let me just say this. it sounds to me like you're saying that if a person died merely believing in God, like Abraham did, before Christ came, that person could maybe go to heaven that way without being baptized. But after Jesus came, it got harder to go to heaven. Actually, people who could have been saved without baptism before Jesus came, now that he's come, they can't get saved without baptism. So Jesus made salvation less accessible, right, than it was before?
I actually think he made it easier because the requirements prior with sacrifice and the things that came along with that, now it's just that you have grace, and by believing, now that you believe and that you repented and you were baptized, and in baptism where it said you are not saved by, where it said it, as in the day of Noah, where eight souls are saved by water, in the like figure, in the like figure.
Okay, well, we're going to run out of time here, so let me see if I can get under your, I'm not entirely sure what you mean by some of the terms you're using. It sounds like you're saying that we don't have to obey God now if we just believe in and are baptized. Then it's easier than it was in the Old Testament because we don't have to obey God, and they did. I believe we have to obey God every bit as much as they did.
No, I definitely believe that we have to obey God. I believe.
Okay.
What I'm talking about is this:
the man who died, the thief on the cross who died, he died before Jesus did. Okay.
Yeah.
Not really. He died after Jesus did. Jesus was already dead when they broke the guy's legs, but Jesus hadn't risen yet when the man died. So we put him in the old covenant, and he was allowed to go to paradise without being baptized. But is it your opinion that the same man, if he was dying on a cross 10 years later, and he turned to Christ or turned his heart to God and said, Lord, remember me when you come to your kingdom, that because he did not get baptized, he could not have gone to heaven then because it was now the case that Jesus had died and risen again? So Is that your opinion? I mean, everyone who argues this particular point says, well, this man died, I didn't have to be baptized because it was before the cross, it was before the New Testament. But what if the same situation happened after the coming of the New Testament? Would that man not be saved because he was not baptized?
Well, it kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier with the young lady in reference to your walk with Christ and what you do while you're here. And if you believe, you will walk a certain path. And I guess if it was meant for them to have salvation, they would have walked in that path and would have had baptism, would have been baptized prior to their death. But not, I don't necessarily know. Obviously. Oh,
so are you saying that if a person repents on their deathbed now, but dies instantly afterwards, like the man on the cross did, if that happened in our present day and age, that person would not be saved, even though that man was?
Again, it's not for me to say. It says God will have mercy upon who he has mercy on. But
well, sure. Okay, but that's just the point. That's just the point. If baptism is an inflexible requirement for justification, then you could say with certainty, because there are, if you say, okay, baptism is an absolute necessity for justification, if we say that, then we are absolutely saying that someone who doesn't get baptized isn't justified. Now, when I say, well, there could be exceptions. Okay, well, I accept that. I believe that we are required to be baptized. I think that's the normal Christian thing to do. We're commanded to do it, and we must do it. But if somebody can't, then are they unsaved because they believe in Christ but don't get a chance to be baptized? I think that God isn't that legalistic about it. I think that faith is what justifies us. And if we are believers, we will obey Christ, including being baptized. And every Christian in the New Testament who had the opportunity did just that. And that's my point. I'm sorry I'm out of time. I wish we could talk longer. We have other people waiting, as I predicted. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, this is the time of year we're deciding if we're going to stay on these stations. You can write to us or donate online. The address can be found at thenarrowpath.com, or you can donate at thenarrowpath.com. Have a good weekend. Let's talk again Monday.